Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 96, reciting the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Hey, noble one, as you have such a ghostly body, you encounter relatives and familiar places as if in a dream. When you meet these relatives, though you communicate with them, they do not answer. When you see your relatives and dear ones crying, you will think, now I have died, what can I do? You feel a searing pain like a fish flapping in hot sand. But however greatly you suffer, tormenting yourself at this time does not help. If you have a spiritual teacher, pray to your spiritual teacher, or else pray to the compassionate archetype deity. Don't be attached to your loved ones, it is useless. Pray to the compassionate ones and do not suffer or be terrified. Hey, noble one, hey, Natasha. Driven by the swift wind of evolution, your mind is helpless and unstable, riding the horse of breath like a feather blown on the wind, spinning and fluttering. You tell the mourners, don't cry, here I am, but they take no notice. And you realize you have died and you feel great anguish. Now do not indulge in your pain. There is a constant twilight, gray as the pre-dawn autumn sky, neither day nor night. That kind of between can last for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7 weeks, up to 49 days. Though it is said that for most people the suffering of the existence between lasts 21 days, this is not always certain due to people's different evolutionary histories. Hey, noble one, at this time the great wind, hey, Natasha, at this time the great wind of evolution will drive you from behind, fiercely, unbearably, terrifyingly. Don't be afraid of it, it is your own hallucination. A frightening, thick darkness draws you from the front irresistibly. You are terrified by harsh cries such as strike, kill. Don't be afraid of them. Heavy sinners will see cannibal ogres brandishing many weapons, shouting war cries. Kill, kill, strike, strike. You will see ferocious wild animals. You will be hunted by troops in blizzards, storms, and fogs. You will hear sounds of avalanches, floodwaters, forest fires, and hurricanes. In panic, you will escape by any means, only to stop short on the brink of falling down a yawning triple abyss, red, black, and white, bottomless and horrifying. That's your own central channel, actually. The red, black, and white abyss. That's the tunnel that they see in the near-death experience, but it's the central channel, actually, in the body of the being. Hey, noble one, it is not really an abyss. It is lust, hate, and delusion. Oh, yes, well, those are the central channels. In their negative form. You should recognize this as the moment of the existence between. Call upon the Lord of great compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum, that is. That's why we recited Om Mani Padme Hum. That is always helpful. When you get better than counting sheep when you can't sleep, just get on your Om Mani Padme Hum channel, you know, and presence of Avalokiteshvara is manifest. O Lord, pray intensely. O Lord of great compassion, spiritual teacher, three jewels incarnate. I am named so-and-so. Please don't, you know, when you think of a particular being like Avalokiteshvara or something as a three jewels incarnate, or like one's guru, then what it is it's not like that being is an extra jewel. It's like the mind of that being is the Buddha, the speech of that being is the Dharma, and the body of that being is the Sangha. So the three jewels of body are their mind, speech, and body. I am named so-and-so. I am named Natasha. Please don't abandon me to the horrid states. Don't forget me. Those who have gathered merit, virtuous and sincere in Dharma practice, are entertained with various delights and enjoy various excellent pleasures. And those dominated by delusion who have neither strong virtue nor strong vice, have neither happiness nor suffering, but feel only stupefaction and indifference. O noble one, whatever happens along those lines, don't crave, don't long for pleasures or joys. Offer them all to the jewel of the spiritual teacher. Abandon attachment to them, even without any visions of pleasure or pain, with only feelings of indifference. Set the mind on the experience of the great seal, that is the ecstatic embrace of the whole of reality, free of both concentration and distraction. That is most important. Hey, noble one, structures such as bridges, temples, cathedrals, huts, and stupas will seem to shelter you for a moment, but don't cling to them at length. Since your mind lacks a coarse body, it should be really, although it just said body, but it means coarse body, it cannot settle down. You feel cold, you become angry and distraught, and your awareness seems erratic, volatile, and unsteady. Then you will have the thought, now I have died, what can I do? Your heart will feel cold and weak. You will feel fierce and boundless suffering. The fact is, you must travel and cannot be attached to any one place. So don't worry about it and let your mind come to rest. From now on, you have no food except for what is dedicated for you. There is no certainty about your friends. These are signs of your mental body wandering in the existence between. Your present joys and sorrows are determined by your evolution. When you see your lands, friends, loved ones, and your own corpse, and you think, now I have died, what can be done at that time? Your mental body feels greatly stressed. You think how nice it would be to have a new body. Then you will have visions of looking everywhere for a body. Even if you try up to 9 times to enter your old corpse, due to the length of the reality between, in the winter it will have frozen, in the summer it will have rotted. Otherwise your loved ones will have burned it or buried it or given it to birds and beasts so it affords no place to inhabit. You will feel sick at heart and you will have visions of being squeezed between boulders, stones, and dirt. This kind of suffering is in the nature of the existence between. Even if you find a body, there will be nothing other than such suffering. So give up longing for a body. Focus yourself undistractedly in the experience of creative non-action. Hey, noble one, you, Natasha. This suffering of yours comes from your own evolutionary acts. There is no one else to blame. It is your own evolution, so pray strongly to the 3 jewels. They can protect you. If you don't pray to them, don't know how to meditate on the Great Seal, and don't meditate on an archetype deity, then your native angel will count out a white stone for each virtue you accumulated, and your native demon will count out a black stone for every sin. Then you will be very worried, angry, and terrified, trembling. You will lie, saying, I committed no sins. But then Yama, the judge of the dead, will say, I will look into the mirror of evolution. When he looks into the mirror of evolution, all your sins and virtues will clearly and distinctly appear therein. Your lies will not help. Yama will tie a rope around your neck and lead you away. He will cut off your head, rip out your heart, pull out your guts, lick your brain, drink your blood, eat your flesh, and gnaw your bones. But since you cannot die, even though your body is cut to pieces, you revive again. Being cut up again and again, you will suffer immense pain. But when the white stones are being counted, don't be afraid, don't panic, do not lie. Don't fear Yama. Your body is mental, so even if it is killed and cut up, you cannot die. In fact, your form is the void itself, so you have nothing to fear. The Yama deities are your own hallucinations and themselves are forms of the void. Your own instinctual mental body is void. Voidness cannot harm voidness. Signlessness cannot harm signlessness. You should recognize that there is nothing other than your own hallucination. There is no external substantially existent Yama, angel, demon, or bull-headed ogre, and so on. You must recognize all this as the between. Meditate on the samadhi of the great seal. You embrace everything ecstatically, even what seems harmful, even blades coming at you and so on. If you don't know how to meditate, examine carefully whatever terrifies you and see the voidness that is its lack of objective status. That is the natural body of truth. And that voidness is not merely an annihilation. Your triumphant, distinct awareness of the terror of the void is itself the blissful mind of the body of beatitude. Terror and bliss. Again, like remember, the bliss body of beatitude was the fierce deities. And the Dharmakaya peaceful body was the peaceful deities, the mild deities, remember, in the earlier part. Here again is terror and bliss are interconnected. Because both are causing a melting of the sense of subjective separation. Voidness and clarity are indistinguishable. The actuality of the void is clarity. The actuality of clarity is void. Your awareness of voidness, clarity, indivisible, is stripped naked. And now you abide in the unfabricated experience. That is the wisdom body of truth. And that spontaneously, unobstructedly arises anywhere. Last night I thought of it suddenly, somehow it seemed very, and I mentioned to Annie that consciously, because she asked that question, consciously is the only way actually we can know our unity in the wisdom body of truth. We can only know it unconsciously, because what we normally think of as consciously is a subject conscious, being conscious of an object. But since we are the wisdom body of truth, we cannot know it as a subject-object dual thing. We are knowing it by being it. And so in our unconsciousness of being it, and being unconscious of it as something separate from us, is our conscious knowing of it as one with us. It kind of works. That's really cool. And that is why they say, you know, in Prajnaparamita, they say, wisdom knows voidness by the method of not knowing, by the mode of non-perception. So wisdom knows voidness, freedom, by the mode of non-perceiving. And therefore, anyone who says, I have a perception of voidness, is wrong. What they are having is a perception of the threshold of the awareness of voidness, where they seem to melt into unconsciousness. So they remember having become unconscious and sort of just vast space. But voidness is only known unconsciously. And therefore, it does not interfere with the conscious knowledge of differentiation. And therefore, the real knowledge of voidness is only the non-duality of the space-like equipoise samadhi and the dream-like aftermath samadhi, where you see all differentiated things again. In which case there is no having of an awareness of voidness, except by the mode of non-having. Which is why they say in the Prajnaparamita that the person who says, oh, I understand voidness, I have an understanding of voidness, or I have an experience of voidness, is mistaken. They have that sense as a possession. You can remember having had a moment of disappearing. You can remember that. I have a moment where I exploded into vast space. But your oneness with that vast space, the subject is equally a space as the object, and therefore the subject does not have that knowledge as a subject-object distinct knowledge. In the normal sense of have something other than yourself. You can say, I have myself, but it becomes meaningless when you have yourself equally to having everything else. Then there's no having, because you are yourself and everything. That's really good. That's really good. That is the wisdom body of truth, and that spontaneously and unobstructedly arises anywhere. And that is the body of compassionate emanation. That door is too drafty. What? Oh, took away the stone. Thank you. Thank you, Jack. Hey, noble one, Natasha. Noble ones, all of you. Me, noble one, me. Behold this without wavering. Recognize it. You will definitely become a Buddha, the perfection of the four bodies. Do not be distracted. This is the borderline between a Buddha and an ordinary being. Now is the time described as one instant alienated, one instant perfectly enlightened. Until yesterday, you were given to distraction. You did not recognize what arose as the between, and you were gripped by so much terror. If you again surrender to distraction, the cord of compassion will be cut, and you will go into the abodes that lack all freedom. So be careful. Be mindful. Careful. So this is in the area of what is called Mahamudra meditation or Great Perfection meditation, Dzogchen meditation. It's in this kind of area where you sort of emphasize, you know, being infinity in a certain way. In other words, right, we are both simultaneously finite and infinite. As infinite, infinity recognizes no difference between everything else and ourselves, you could say. I mean, infinity is just a concept, but in other words, right, infinite, we are permeated by infinity. All finite beings are. Because we can't exclude it. We can't push it out of a periphery or perimeter of our sense of boundary. Because it's infinite, so it's everywhere. So on that channel of infinity, we, without even needing to know, we are infinite. In a way, we know it by inference, by reason, in a way. In a very direct way, through negation. Infinite is a negative, not finite. Voidness is a negation. Selflessness is a negation. So, in a way, when you settle toward that tendency in yourself, that awareness in yourself, like you will definitely be a Buddha. This is what I resort to myself. It's what I call consolation prize. Consoling myself for the fact that I've been trying to get enlightenment in this life 45 years and I'm still failing. I console myself by realizing that I will get enlightened. I listen to this. You will become a Buddha in some future universe when my dense, stubborn egotism has finally worn itself out or whatever, or I've seen through it. And at that time, the difference in time between now and then will be meaningless. And I will be aware of this time perfectly. Like, because to become a Buddha, you remember all your previous existences with absolute clarity, which means you remember your infinity. But in specific, not a vague sort of nothingness infinity, but a specific infinity, including illusorily all its discrete and differentiated manifestations. And therefore, I will be aware of this moment. I will be back in my current awareness. Then, except that then I will be consciously unconscious instead of unconsciously conscious. I will be consciously unconscious of my oneness with my future Buddhahood. So I'll be enjoying this moment as a Buddha retroactively. That's my consolation. So here is, in a way, they are saying the same thing. One instant alienated, one instant perfectly enlightened. From the Buddha's perspective, this is the same instant. From the alienated person's, it's, of course, a very different instant. The Buddha instant is millions of lifetimes in the future, or billion, or countless. So then the Dzogchen thing is like, projecting oneself on the Mahamudra thing, and actually the Zen thing in its own way, is projecting oneself into that the Dharma freedom, the ultimate reality of Dharma freedom is right here and now. It's, this moment is infinite. And so the mindfulness puts one itself in that position through inference in a way, through a super fast intuitive rational inference. And then seeks to cleanse off or eliminate or critique all those feelings and subject-object and egocentric awarenesses that don't feel like that, which one realistically cannot just get into denial of. And so it's a matter of sort of, this is what is called, in some ways, it's sometimes said to be one of the dividing lines between sutra and tantra. It's because it's called, there's the two modes, which are means vehicle and goal vehicle, it's called. So means vehicle, or causal vehicle, and effect vehicle. So causal vehicle means you're practicing something under the, leaving intact the supposition that what you're practicing is in order to attain something that you haven't yet attained. So you're on the path, You're developing the causes of that attainment. A goal vehicle or effect vehicle means that you are projecting your... It also is a vehicle. So it isn't that you, just by saying, I'm one with the Absolute, doesn't make you one with the Absolute in your full visceral, instinctual transforming and transmuting experience like Buddhahood. Just saying that I am one with Buddha doesn't make you Buddha. But by projecting yourself into the way you actually are in the vision of a Buddha, and then working to critique and to sort of separate yourself from all those habitual reactions and perceptions and image and self-images and instincts that you have that are based on your being apart from a Buddha or and apart from the world and the ego center apart from the world, an alienated individual, is this more powerful, different procedure. And again, it tends... Now, it's also in Prajnaparamita, in sutra system or exoteric system, it is said there are two kinds of sutras, and the dialecticist centrist type or Prasangika Madhyamaka type within the exoteric philosophy also says that only the fruitional vehicle type of teaching is definitive in meaning. So there's a way of approaching this type of thing even in exoteric ways. So it isn't exactly a dividing line between exoteric and esoteric, but it tends to be a dividing line, because if the egocentric individual is told, oh, you're an instant Buddha just by hearing this teaching about great perfection, or just by hearing the word initiation, like you are Buddha, and so on, and being given license to cultivate what's called the divine pride or the Buddha pride or the Buddha confidence, then that person will misunderstand that and will develop their ego into I'm a Buddha in an egocentric way, and will then become megalomaniac and are psychotic, actually. And they'll go around like they'll go around in this fragile eggshell bubble of like, I've got to be a Buddha, and therefore everything I do and think is perfect, and therefore I can't do anything wrong, so therefore every wrong thing I do has got to be perfect. And then if they're unlucky, they have followers who get into this psychosis with them, and we have a cult. That's why the esoteric teachings are esoteric. Because one has to genuinely have an understanding of selflessness and the constructedness of any sense of identity. Even a Buddha identity is a construction, as well as an alienated individual identity is a construction. And one has to have a very strong inferential knowledge merging on the visceral, but it doesn't have to be fully visceral, but one has to have a strong conscious, at least, understanding of that. Or it's not safe to go into goal vehicle type of practices or fruitional vehicle type of teachings like Dzogchen or thing. Therefore, for example, the good people who teach Dzogchen or who teach thing or teach even this, or even which this is a good people, this book written by good people for ordinary people, but it's emphasizing the Dzogchen style of thing, constantly refers to the Mahamudra and Dzogchen. And they are doing that, but they're saying, well, we don't expect you to really be able to do this, and what you must do are all these preliminaries and take refuge and develop your spirit of enlightenment, develop your renunciation, develop your detachment, develop your awareness that these are projections of your mind, develop your wisdom. You know, so in other words, they're just, in a way, using that as a sort of seed of inspiration rather than really pretending to people. The bad ones who teach that are the ones who really pretend that when you hear about Dzogchen, then that you're there, you know. You know, it's like if the Zen master just tells you, you are Buddha just sitting, then you are. That leads to psychosis. And in a community, it leads to a cult. Is that clear? I think that's very clear. It's clear today. It is. Tragic in some cases. There's some tragic cases going on right now that I'm aware of. So close and yet so far. My own fault. Can't manifest. It's a fierce deed. Clearly enough. Oh, hey, noble one. If you don't know how to meditate thus, so that was a deep kind of round on the sort of non-duality that they gave us there. Wisdom, body of truth, spontaneously and unobstructedly arises anywhere, body of compassionate emanation. Then remember and pray to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and the compassionate lords, like Avalokiteshvara and others. Contemplate all the terrors and visions as the compassionate lord or your own archetype deity. Remember your esoteric initiation name and the spiritual teacher who gave you the initiations you received in the human realm. Proclaim them to Yama, the Lord of Truth. Then you won't be injured even if you fall off cliffs. So abandon all fear and hate. The present visions will propel you into the hardship of the changing states of pleasure and pain as if flung by a catapult. Now, if you're reading this to one of your own beloveds who died recently, and then you kind of get maybe discouraged because you think, if that beloved was not one given to a certain type of diction, or even didn't know about archetype deity or Lord of Truth or like, you know, Great Seal or whatever it is, but what am I reading this to them for? Then you must remember this, and I think we skipped it. I think it was already in the book, but somewhere we didn't actually see it in the text, but it's there somewhere. The person in the between state is 9 times more intelligent than they were in life. Especially if they have a little dementia in the old age where they're kind of in and out of their coarse brain, then and therefore not in grip of their best vocabulary and not aware of their deeper intuitions and whatever, you know, or in and out in lucidity about it. The minute they're out of that coarse brain and they're creating a brain-like neural pattern of subtle energy as a between state being. Because, of course, a between state being does have a body, like a magic body, a mind-made body. And therefore, they do have a brain, and therefore that brain has no plaque. Because it's made in pure virtual reality, pure subtle energy. And yet the neural pattern reproduces completely. Although it can fade, it's very unstable. But they're 9 times more intelligent. So you shouldn't presume that, oh, they won't understand as if flung by a catapult because they don't know the word catapult. Because they don't speak English or something. You know what I'm saying? Or whatever language you're reading this in. Actually, this was translated into Russian. Tibetskaya Knyaga Mertvukh, or something like that. Is that roughly the pronunciation? All right. Tibetskaya Knyaga. Knyaga Mertvukh, right? Mertvukh. Something like that. Book of the Dead, right? Tibetskaya Snega Myoto. Oh, I love Russian. Oh, I must learn to speak it. I'm just pathetic. Can't do everything. So, do not be absorbed in any visions of love or hate. Even when you're about to be born in the higher estates, like the heavens or the Titan realm or the human realm, when the visions of the higher estates arise, should the relatives you have left behind begin to make sacrifices, with the slaughter of living beings in some cultures, you know, where they think they should sacrifice an animal when someone dies. To dedicate them to the Lord of Death, you will have many impure visions that begin to feel fierce anger. And this is amazing karma. You know, this is a story. One of the Buddha's 2 most favorite disciples, Hinayana, you know, monk disciples, one was Shariputra and one was Mahamudgalyayana. And Mahamudgalyayana was a tremendous yogi. Both were. And both were arhats, saints, enlightened. In the Theravada way, on the conscious level, enlightened. Had experienced the kind of nirvana already on the conscious level, but instinctually not brought yet along because of not doing the Bodhisattva path, not doing the Mahayana. That Mahamudgalyayana died, was murdered actually, beaten to death by a crowd, amazingly. Life is so strange. Because with his amazing magical powers that he had as a meditator in life, you know, he's almost like, almost you could say, magic body practice, although not as a tantric siddha, as an arhat, a Theravada arhat. He heard the cries in a hell of a guru who had been reborn in hell and was screaming with pain because every time his disciple, and he was a guru of a cult that did animal sacrifice extensively, like Vedic kind of cult that sacrificed animals, which in before Buddha's time they used to do. Now they're all vegetarians, the Vedic Brahmins, except in a few cases, but they, in ancient time, they did a lot of animal sacrifice. And their Vedic prescriptions prescribe animal sacrifice, in fact, which would horrify modern Vedic vegetarian Brahmins who think of themselves as Vedic. But it's one of those Old Testament dudes where they don't pay attention to the old story, you know? They just like the magic sound, you know? And anyway, every time they did a sacrificial ritual, which they thought they were doing as the instructions of their guru, that guru would have a rain of molten metal on his head in hell. And he was like horrified. He said, Mahamad Galyayana, please go tell him to cut it out. And so he did. And then they beat him to death. They were so angry. They didn't believe him, you know. That's how Mahamad Galyayana died. Amazing. Karma is just incredible. Conditioned by that, you will be reborn in hell. In other words, you're about to be born in a heaven, and then, or human, and then some followers or something, or your family are doing some really stupid thing, killing some chicken or something. And conditioned by that, you'll be reborn in hell. So, you know, this is why the one thing Buddhist, you could say, if you say missionary, in a way they were, but missionaries like a university is a missionary institution. You know, university has a mission of wanting people to gain critical insight, to learn, like, not to be fundamentalist and fanatic, to develop reason, you know what I mean, to develop skill in different kinds, in science and so forth, and be more realistic and so on, and be less racist and less prejudiced and less sexist and so on. That's a university's mission. That's a missionary thing, to have a university system so people in a population will be less demented, less like Rush Limbaugh and company. Somehow he shows how pathetic their job is in the United States, because Limbaugh is a Harvard graduate. So he managed to get through and get all the cleverness and the connections and all this and the rhetoric and yet be a complete moral horror. Conditioned by that, you will be reborn in hell. So therefore, one thing that Buddhism did in India and everywhere they went is they tried their utmost to block any kind of animal sacrifice practice. In other words, they left Brahmanism, Hinduism. They criticized the Vedas because the Vedas taught animal sacrifice. And even human sacrifice, actually, in some areas that they've purged nowadays, censored, in the very, very ancient stratum of the Veda. And in China they did, you know, and, you know, everywhere. So that's the one point, you know. Otherwise they left Thor, they would have left Thor and Wotan, whatever, but any blood sacrifice they would have gotten after. And the way Christianity does the same, in that the communion, the wafer and the wine, is a surrogate for a blood sacrifice. But they're against the blood sacrifice. Yeah. And you see why they had to not be tolerant of that. That's where they drew the line about being tolerant of whatever the local practices were. Because by doing that, the people were creating a hellish type of future for themselves. Through the killing, through the sacred killing. So no matter what actions are committed among the surviving, do not become angry, but contemplate love. So anyway, if you happen to be have some silly relatives who go and do some sacrifices after you die, if you don't get angry about it and upset, even though it's harming you, then you will avoid the consequence yourself. Or if you yourself have great attachment to the wealth and possessions you left behind, or if you know that others are using your possessions, you will feel attached to them and angry at the people that are using them. Don't do that. Conditioned by that, even though you might have attained the highest states, you will be reborn in hell or the Pretan realms. Therefore, even if you are attached to your old possessions, you have no power to own them anymore. They have no use to you at all. Abandon fondness and attachment for your possessions. Therefore, there's a huge thing in Buddhist cultures like a potlatch thing where you try to give everything away before you die. Don't totally throw them away. Be decisive. Totally throw them away. Be decisive. Whoever uses your things, don't be stingy. Who cares? Let go of them in your mind. Generate a one-pointed will to offer them all to the spiritual teacher and the three jewels and abide in the experience of detachment and unconcern. This is a really great one. I love this. When death rites such as exorcistic food offering rites or other rites that purify the dangers of the horrid states are performed for your sake, here they're offering grains and things and not animals, you know, so that's okay. And with your subtle evolutionary clairvoyance, you perceive the performers, that is the priests who are doing it, as being inaccurate, sleepy, or distracted, breaking their vows and commitments and acting carelessly. And you notice their lack of faith, distorted views, fearful negative actions, and impure practices. And this goes also for your relatives. If some of them are maybe who didn't like you that much in life and they're ambivalent and they're thinking, well, good riddance, you know. Although they're going, ooh, 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 poor so-and-so, poor Joe, poor Bob. But then secretly they're thinking, good riddance. And you know that with your clairvoyance. And you say, alas, these people are betraying me. They are letting me down. They don't really like me. And you become depressed and you become disgusted and you lose your positive attitude and all respect. And you become cynical and disillusioned. Conditioned by that, you will be reborn in the horrid states, and thus their actions rather than helping you will harm you greatly. So whatever your surviving relatives perform in the way of incorrect religious rites or thoughts, you must think, well, my perception is certainly imperfect. How could any impurity adhere to the Buddha's teaching? I see this as a result of my own negative attitude, like seeing the mirror's faults as if in my own form. The bodies of these performers are the Sangha. Their speech is the holy Dharma. Their minds are the actual Buddha, so I must take refuge in them. So they're all Buddhas anyways, but never mind. You must respect them and project your most positive attitude upon them. And then whatever your dear ones do for you will definitely help you. Such keeping of a positive attitude is very important, so do it without forgetting. I love that. It's like in the Tao Te Ching, you know, they say that the sage, no one can ever lie to the sage because he believes whatever everyone tells him. So there's never any lie. You know, they say that. Lao Tzu says that. I like that. That's really great. I'm a little notorious at funerals when I'm asked to give a speech, because I often scold the departed one, especially if they die young. Like, I don't get, other people get this thing like, it's all perfect, just how it had to happen. And I don't do that. I'm like openly annoyed, especially if someone is a colleague of mine or something. I say, you tall bum, you're up there lounging in the pure land, and here we are slaving away around here. And you left us all behind, you could be helping us. Get reborn quick, get back to work. I do. I'm very bad. A great sinner. Even if you are heading for rebirth in the three horrid states, when the visions of the horrid states arise, when you see the pure virtue unsullied with sins performed by your surviving relatives, and when you see the perfect physical, verbal, and mental practices of your spiritual teachers and mentors, then when you are compelled to rebirth, your feeling of great delight has the invaluable benefit of lifting you up into the higher estates, just as you are about to be reborn in the horrid states. So be very careful, as it is so important for you to construct a positive attitude of reverence and faith and not allow any place for impure negativity of perception. That's a really great thing. You know, that is a tantric practice. But, you know, in a way, when we do this, and this is typical Tibetan, it's why Tibetans have taken the Indian great teachings, which they revere as the holiest teachings. They don't think we made anything in Tibet. But what they make in Tibet is they put them together in these fabulous ways. Like, for example, when you meditate, if you take the trouble before you meditate on whatever theme you're going to meditate, like counting your breath, whatever basic meditation, or you're meditating on compassion, may everyone be happy, may they be all well, and all this kind of thing, whatever it is, or wisdom on selflessness, looking for yourself, you first take the trouble to critique your habitual perception of yourself as your ordinary self and your environment as your ordinary environment. And realize that, you know, you kind of, it's partly your construction, at least, if not totally, it's partly your construction. Because it's the way you see it habitually. And so by looking more critically at it and realizing it, that, you know, you can't sort of find it objectively being the way it seems to be in your habitual way in itself, and then melt it down with that critical or that doubt, that focused doubt, and let it become freedom, voidness, in its deeper reality. Even just by inference, even if you can't actually see through it or see through yourself, but by inference, just let go of whatever your habitual picture of yourself is, and then arise in your ideal meditative mind-made magic energy body, and then see yourself in the perfect environment, your ideal visualized environment, top of the world, you know, snowy peaks, Mount Kailash behind you, Lake Manasarovar in front of you, in the middle of the lake, the magic island, on the island, the jewel tree of refuge, on that tree, all enlightened beings of all religious traditions, all philosophical traditions, all scientific traditions, all everyone, your old math teacher from high school, your French teacher, whatever, and your parents, your uncles and aunts, you know, whoever to you seems to be someone who helped you at any time in your life and who knew something you did and helped you learn it. And especially those you think of as knowing the deepest things that you need to know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and angels and whoever, God, all there present, blessing you, flowing lights upon you, all the other beings around you with you so you don't feel missing any of them, and then you're reflecting this light back to them so you're doing it for their sake as well as your sake so you have a stronger motive. You take the trouble to do that even though you may not have visualizational, stable ability where you can really hold such a picture in your mind strongly, just like right now, none of us could probably remember what the roof of this room really looks like, even though we've been looking at it and we're now not, but yet it's there. We have a sense it's there. So you have a sense that that different picture, that ideal picture, that perfect picture is there, and you're in the perfectly positive place. And also about yourself, that you're not the habitual one who, oh, I never succeed in meditating. Oh, my mind is so distracted. I meditate, and it doesn't seem to help. And then when I go to the office, they piss me off anyway, and I feel horrible. And, you know, I got to have another cup of coffee. And, you know, all this habitual personality, you try to leave that behind, and you go through leaving it behind and being in this, okay, I'm alert. I can learn something new. I can change. I do learn new things all the time. You know, I'm going to get something new in this meditation, even if it's only 5 minutes long, blah, blah. Sort of get really an image of yourself as a totally open-minded, high potential realizing person, your ideal person of yourself as a continuum of pure learning. You go through the trouble to create that setting. Then what you do in the meditation, even if you meditate 10 minutes, and even you can't, you just set that up kind of, go through the setting up of the refuge tree, the refuge field, the shrine space. As I go, like I give this out, I try to describe this in the Jewel Tree of Tibet book. But the Dalai Lama describes in his book, Path of Bliss, I mean, a lot of people describe this. You get a tanka of some refuge field or a picture, you know, you have your own shrine, even you're not, you know, at home, you have your meditation closet where you put these things, sort of like whatever reminds you of these things. Then you are have a different thing because you have the part you're sort of without being worrying about being initiated or being sort of tantric vows and gurus, a specific one, and worrying is that the right guru or the good persons or nasty persons or whatever. You're making in your mind ideal, and therefore you're in the context of that ideal, and therefore you can carry on with greater impetus in your understanding. And you won't be telling yourself. One of the reasons people have a hard time understanding like teachings of selflessness, they, oh, that's so complicated. Oh, I'm not a philosopher. I can't understand that. Oh, no. Oh, I just want a blessing. I just want to see a nice guru, whatever. Is that they're telling themselves they can't understand. They've internalized the voices of some scolding mom or dad, or you can't understand. You don't know what's going on. Or some teacher in some school that they've even forgotten that they ever had, who used to tell them, or some rival or some brother or sister who kept saying, you can't, oh, you're so stupid, you didn't know this, you didn't know that. And then they constantly tell themselves that. And then they, of course, who said that? Some Hermes Trismegistus, show me your beginning and I'll show you your end. Let me show me your starting point and I'll show you where you'll end up. So you shift your starting point to start. And that's a tantric method called the purification of perception, where you consciously visualize everything as perfect. You visualize all other beings as Buddhas and Bodhisattvas pretending to be ordinary beings to be around you to encourage you to attain enlightenment. You visualize this turkey of a guru who is like has arthritis and diabetes and is overweight and can't speak English and whatever, and is like has vanity and has problems. But you visualize them as the Buddha incarnate when they teach you. And then, according to clever Tibetan proverb, you make sure to live three valleys away so you don't see their daily flaws. And you don't actually listen to their dumb orders necessarily. And yet you can put them in your mind on a pedestal because you received some teaching from them. And whether or not they even understood it themselves, they were the channel of it to you. So this is a very tricky thing, but they put it there into the most exoteric basic teaching of the path. So they give you the benefit of these more empowering practices without you being committed to the worrying about keeping them together and to plant a sort of seed, subliminal seed in your intuition and your instinct that you're supposed to be thus positive. You know, that's what they're doing here with the bardo person. They're saying, even your clairvoyance lets you know that these relatives are going, good riddance, glad to get rid of so-and-so, can't wait to go and have their car and their house and their favorite ring and whatever it is. And yet you don't care. Oh, that's perfect. They're making it beautiful and it's great. I didn't have time to give it when I was alive and now I'm giving it and they're using it, enjoying it. I hope they're enjoying my underwear, whatever. That's really, really purification of perception. And now a being in the between state can understand these things immediately. You know, they're so much more sharp and intelligent than in an ordinary course life. 9 times more intelligent. Somewhere in here it says. They're great. I love them. I must take refuge in them. Of course, you know, and the Tibetan tradition, this have to be careful because then the guru who's creating a cult, then people think, oh, I should still purify my perception and think of them as perfect. And then I should do whatever they say. That's not true. In the tantric, once you get into the esoteric teaching, they have a lot of defense things. If the guru is acting like an idiot, you can say, oh, I'm going to put you on a pedestal in my mind as I meditate, but, oh boy, I'm going to get out of your space in town because you're giving out a lot of dumb orders and you're creating a cult, and I'm not going to agree with you, and I'm going to be critical of your unethical and stupid behavior. But I'm not going to connect that criticism to destroying the icon I have you in my mind. You're stuck with that, buddy. You nasty llama. I'm going to make you Buddha when I'm like in the next county. But I'm not going to when you're like want me to go and like, you know, crawl around on the floor or something. That I won't do. That's this peace that we people can't get yet in our country. Sort of the resiliency, the flexibility of personality. You know. Hey, Noble One, in short, since your present between consciousness is highly unstable, volatile, and mobile, and virtuous or vicious perception is very powerful, don't think at all about any non-virtuous evolution and remember your own virtuous practice. If you have no virtuous practice, then adopt a positive perception and feel faith and reverence. Pray to your archetype deity and to the Lord of Compassion, and with intense willpower perform this prayer. Now let's all read it together. Now that I wander alone, anybody who has the book or share, now that I wander alone, it's okay if you don't have to just mentally read it together, without my loved ones and all my visions are but empty images, may the Buddhas exert the force of their compassion and stop the fear and hate-drawn terrors of the between. Now when I suffer by the power of negative evolution, may my archetype deities dispel my suffering. When reality crashes with 1,000 thunders, may they all become Om Mani Padme Hum. When I'm pulled by evolution without recourse, may the Lord's mild and fierce dispel my suffering. When I suffer due to evolutionary instincts, may clear light, bliss, samadhi arise for me. Okay, now we go on avoiding the dull lights. So, you know, this is this process, you know, where there's a continuous process, and yet at every juncture in the process, they're reading you, trying to give you some way of breaking free from being caught in the machine of the mechanical samsara driven by your own instinctual propensities. You know, because you have not meditated enough, you have not psychotherapied yourself meditationally or personally or interpersonally, and you have not gone down to the unconscious and cleaned out the Augean stables. You have not become the Heruka, the Hercules, to clean out your own Augean stables. And so you're being driven helplessly by these unconscious instincts. And so, but each time there's another chance for you to project yourself out, to impel yourself up. We avoid the six lights. Remember, these we've encountered already: dull light of the gods, red light of the titans, blue light of the humans, green light of the animals, yellow light of the pretons, and dull smoky light of the hell. All these will dawn. These are the six lights. And your body turns any of those colors. You don't want to get into that. You recognize them and you avoid them. At the time, the essence of the instruction is very important. Contemplate the particular light that arises as if it were Avalokiteshvara. When the light arises, hold the thought, it is the Lord of great compassion. This is the extremely profound. You get non-dual. You invite, in a way, Avalokiteshvara to be there in that, as that light, so that you don't somehow long for that light, that you let that light lift you compassionately. This is crucial to block rebirth in that involuntarily achieved place. Again, meditate long and carefully that whoever your archetype deity is, he or she appears like a magic illusion, lacking intrinsic reality, is called a pure magic body. And contemplate that archetype deity dissolving from the edges inward and enter the experience of not holding rigidly to the insubstantial, the clear light of voidness. Again, contemplate that as the archetype deity. Again, contemplate it as clear light. Thus, meditating deity in clear light and alternation, let your own awareness dissolve from the edges. Where space pervades, let air awareness pervade. Where awareness pervades, let the truth body pervade. Enter comfortably into the experience of the ceaseless non-proliferation of the truth body. So this is how you break out, this is to say break down, break into. This is really taking refuge in Dharma. Truth body means Dharma body. I'm translating as truth there, reality. And so you avoid going into the realm that the light invites you to by first making the light into the archetype deity, then infusing that light with the clear light, then which therefore doesn't move anywhere because the clear light is present everywhere in everything. And then by having stopped, you're being sucked like a tractor by that clear light, tractor beam like that clear by that dull light, whatever one it is. You then take refuge in freedom. You don't have to follow this or that impulsion. You don't have to follow your own impulses. You're free. Your impulses are illusory. They have an illusory quality. There's always a gap you can find. You don't have to follow that impulse. Like, huh, you said that, I have to get mad. No, I don't have to get mad. You know, your mind says, oh, that's going too far, I have to freak out. No, you don't. That's what you're working on with initial mindfulness practice. When you count your breath, or when you say Om Mani Padme Hum, and then you have a distracting thought, and then you learn to dismount from that thought. The way you dismount from that thought is you disidentify that the voice that is saying, oh, what has happened yesterday? Oh boy, that was fun riding down the highway. Oh boy, the blossoms are blooming. Oh gee, I worry about when I get home, did somebody feed the cat? Your mind is shooting off, and you just get off that thought. It's your own voice talking, so you think you have to listen. But mindfulness says, gives you another voice. No, you don't have to listen. You're free not to listen to yourself, not to follow your own thought. You're free to dismount from your thought of worrying about the cat. And you therefore come back to counting the breath, or come back to the... So that ability, which you do at the very beginning of your Dharma mindfulness, your first accessory of enlightenment is the mindfulness, the smriti upasthana, the focus of mindfulness on the body, on the breath. So that is teaching you here to dismount from the feeling that I have an impulse, I got to go to that white, that dull white light, or that dull red light, or that dull green light, or that dull blue light, or that dull smoky light. Especially that one. Boy, I don't have to go there. You're taking refuge in your freedom to not go anywhere that you don't want to go. And not even believe that you want. Be free not to want. Be free not to fear. That's taking refuge in the Dharma. That's the ultimate refuge. That's ceaseless non-proliferation of the truth body. Hey, noble one, now blocking the door of the womb. That is blocking the dull lights, blocking rebirth by being drawn by the dull lights. Now blocking the door of the womb. Now you're sort of back to being a human. If you have not understood from the above, or by this time, at the power of evolution, the vision will arise. If you're proceeding upward on the level of downward, head hanging, now meditate the Lord of great compassion, remember him or her. Then, as you already explained, you'll have the visions of hurricane, blizzard, the merit, escape, merit, happy place, blah, blah. Now the signs will arise showing the continent and place where you will be reborn. For this time, there are many profound keys of instruction, so listen carefully. Even though you did not recognize freedom from the previous keys of orientation here, even those of the weakest practice can recognize freedom through the following keys, so listen. Now here, the method of blocking the womb door is very effective and important. There are two methods of blocking that door, blocking the entering person and blocking the womb door entered. First, the instruction for blocking the enterer. Hey, noble one. You named so-and-so. Clearly visualize your archetype. You named Natasha. Clearly visualize your archetype deity appearing like magic without intrinsic reality, like the moon and water. If you're unsure about your archetype deity, then visually envision Avalokiteshvara, thinking he is the Lord of great compassion. Then dissolve that archetype from the edges and contemplate the void, clear light, transparency of ultimate non-perception. That's our unconscious conscious. Ultimate non-perception. That is the profound key. Using it, the Buddha said, the womb will not be entered, so meditate in that way. Again, they're using this thing of selflessness, voidness, wisdom. But if this still does not block the way and you're about to enter a womb, there is the profound instruction to block the door of the womb about to be entered, so listen. Hey, now when the existence between dawns upon me, I will hold my will with mind one-pointed and increase forcefully the impulse of positive evolution. Blocking the womb door, I will remember to be revulsed. Now courage and positive perception are essential. I will give up envy and contemplate all couples as my spiritual mentor, father, and mother. So the revulsion is the way of guarding against the meditation of revulsiveness. It's like instead of seeing the copulating couple, this is sort of pretty much in the human context, could be animal, but seeing the couple in their passion as skeletons or as bags of flesh and blood and feces and urine and so on, and rather than seeing them in some attractive way as, you know, glamorized by lust, see them in their sort of anatomical reality and be revulsed. And then, you know, and then on the other hand, give up the envy side where you want to rival the male or the female, depending on whether your orientation is to be male or female. Your envy of that, and you contemplate everyone as the Buddha, as the male-female Vajradhara, as your guru, as Vajradhara. And then this changes your, then you have no such lust or compulsion to join their bliss in that way of being born in the womb. And then your willpower is of chief importance. So you see now concentration, so it's very important to meditate in your life, to develop the ability to concentrate. The mindfulness practice is very important. One point in practice, shamatha practice is important. Because here, you see, you have to be able to hold your mind one-pointed. You must stop, because distraction is how your impulses will leak around your willpower and push you somewhere you don't want to go. So you have to develop one-pointedness so you can then put your one-pointedness into your will to freedom. Your one-pointed will is of chief importance. Now you must hold one-pointed in your mind the unwavering willpower. This one-pointed will is of chief importance. It is like the reins to guide a horse. You can achieve whatever your will intends, so don't open your mind to negative evolution, but remember the teachings, instructions, initiations, authorizations, and inspirations you received in the human realm, such as this great book of natural liberation through understanding in the between. And intensify the result of all good evolutionary actions. This is very important. Don't forget it. Don't be distracted. This is the exact time that determines whether you go up or you go down. Now is the time when indulgence in laziness definitely will bring on suffering. Now is the time when one-pointed positive willpower definitely brings on happiness. Hold one-pointed goodwill in your mind, sustain forcefully the result of good action. Now is the time to block the door of the womb. As the root verse says, blocking the womb door, remember to be revulsed. Now courage and positive perception are essential. That time is now. You should block the door of the womb. There are five methods to block the womb door. Now fix them well in your mind. Hey, noble one. At this time, you have visions of couples making love. Here we get to the primal scene. Good old Freud. When you see them, don't enter between them, but stay mindful. Visualize the males and females as the teacher, that means the Buddha, father and mother. Prostrate to them and make them visualized offerings. Feel intense reverence and devotion. aim a strong will to request them to teach the Dharma, and the womb door will definitely be blocked. In other words, don't get drawn into their passionate thing. See them as a Vajradhara teaching Dharma, not as couples, you know, copulating, making impassionately, you know. If that does not block it, and you are not about to enter the womb, then visualize them as mentor father, mother, archetype deity father, mother, or compassion lord, father, mother. Offer them visualized offerings. Form the powerful intention to receive spiritual attainments from them, and that will block the womb door. In other words, you kind of put them in a temple in your mind. Put them in church. Then you kind of don't get, you know, it kind of dims the passion, you know. Put them up on the altar in church, in the temple, in the Buddhist, in the Jokang. You know? But if you can't superimpose that kind of a vision, if that does not block it, you are again about to enter a womb. Then third, because you enter the womb by joining in with their passion, you see. And third, there is the instruction for reversing lust and hate. There are four modes of birth: egg birth, womb birth, magic birth, and warm moisture birth. Egg birth and womb birth are alike. As before, you begin to see males and females engaged in lovemaking. If you enter the womb under the influence of lust and hate, whether you're reborn as a horse, bird, dog, or human, if you're going to be male, you arise appearing to be male. You feel strong hate toward the father and attraction and lust toward the mother. Primal scene, man, thousands of years ago. Freud would have freaked. I can't believe Jung didn't tell Freud about it, or if he did, that Freud didn't make a note. Maybe Freud had died by the time Jung wrote that preface and read this, because Jung was much younger than Freud. That's possible. But I don't know of anybody mentioning that in any of the notes or archives of Freud. There's, oh gee, Carl Jung mentioned that in the Book of the Dead they have like a primal scene. But he surely would have noticed this. If you're going to be female, you appear as a female, and you feel strong envy and jealousy toward the mother. You feel strong longing and lust for the father. Conditioned by that, you enter the path of the womb. You experience orgasmic bliss in the center of the union between white and red drops. And within the experience of that bliss, you faint and lose consciousness. Your body develops through the embryonic stages of custard, gelatin, and so forth, zygote, and so on. Eventually, you will be reborn outside the mother's womb. Once your eyes are open, you realize you have been reborn as a puppy. Or having been a human, now you are a dog. In the dog's kennel, you will suffer. Or in the pig's sty, or in the anthill, or in the wormhole, or in the herds of cows or goats or sheep. Born there, you cannot return to the human state. Being extremely stupid, in a state of delusion, you suffer various miseries. In this way, you will cycle through the hells and the Pretan realms, and you'll be tortured by limitless suffering. There's nothing more powerful, nothing more terrible than this. Alas, alas, those lacking the holy spiritual teacher's instructions fall down this deep abyss into the life cycle. They are tormented uninterruptibly by unbearable suffering, so listen to what I say. Bear these in personal instructions. They're my little bit of pumping you up by tasting the unpleasant, what are called the wretched states, the lower states of animal preta or hell, where we really don't want to go. Now, that's why my one friend, my Lama friend, was so upset about Miss Piggy. Now, I will teach you an instruction to close the womb door by reversing lust and hate. Listen to it and remember it. We read that. Blocking the womb door of the womb, I will remember to be revulsed. Now, courage and positive perception are essential. I will give up envy and contemplate all couples as my spiritual mentor, father, and mother. As before, you will have strong feelings of envy. If you're born as a male, you will lust for the mother, hate the father. If you're born as a female, you will lust for the father, hate the mother. For that, there is the profound. Hey, noble one, when such lust and hate arise, meditate like this. Alas, such a creature of negative evolution as myself will wander in the life cycle under the influence of lust and hate. If I still persist in lust and hate, I will know no end to my wanderings. I am in danger of being sunk forever in the ocean of misery. Now I must give up lust and hate entirely. Alas, I must hold intensely the one-pointed will never to entertain lust and hate. The Tantra states that this meditation itself will close the door of the womb. And the only way to do that is, again, he doesn't go through it, but you have to go to the unconscious, conscious awareness of body of truth. You have to take refuge in the Dharma. You take refuge in the reality of freedom and the unreality of these seemingly irresistible impulses of lust and hate. Very difficult once you're already gripped by it, actually. I don't see that as a too helpful a method, this particular one. But, you know, maybe if the person hears you reading this, who's in this moment, you know, this could be very helpful to them. Hey, noble one, don't waver. Don't worry, in case you didn't remember to read it. I'm sure Avalokiteshvara is reading it. There's a million subtle realm readers who are going out reading this to everybody. Hey, noble one, or speaking to them by heart. Hey, don't waver. Hold your will one pointed in your mind, even though you have done that. If the womb door did not close, you're about to enter the womb. You should block the womb door by the instruction of truthless magical illusion. Meditate as follows. Male and female, father and mother, the thunderstorm, the hurricane, the thunder, terrifying visions, all phenomena are naturally like magical illusions. However they arise, they are truthless. All things are untrue and false. So my feeling of an irresistible impulse is untrue and false. Its irresistibility is untrue and false. I can resist. I can be free. I don't have to do what it makes me feel I have to do, this hate or this lust. Like mirages, impermanent, non-eternal. Why be attached to them? Why fear and hate them? It is to see nothing as something. All of these are but visions of my mind. The mind itself is as originally non-existent as a magical illusion. So where out there do they come from? Since I never understood this in the past, I held the non-existent to exist. I held the untrue to be true. I held illusion as truth. So for this long time, I wandered in the life cycle. If I still now do not recognize the illusoriness of things, I will wander even longer in the life cycle, and I will be stuck in the quicksand of various miseries. So now I will recognize all these things as like a dream, a magical illusion, an echo, a fairy city, a mirage, a reflection, an optical illusion, the moon in water, lacking even a moment's truth status, definitely untrue and false. Thus holding these thoughts one pointedly in mind, the truth habit erodes, and as the resulting freedom is impressed in your continuum, the deeper self habit is reversed, which is the root of the seeming irresistibility of the impulse of lust and hate. As you will thus deeply understand cosmic unreality, the womb door will definitely be blocked. Yet even doing that, if the truth habit does not erode, the womb door is not blocked, and you're about to enter the womb again, there is the profound instruction. Hey, noble one, even doing that, if the womb door is not blocked now, filth, you should block the womb door by meditating on the clear light. You should block the womb door by meditating on the clear light. This is how to contemplate. Hey, all things are my own mind. The mind is voidness, free of creation and destruction. Thinking thus, do not artificially compose your mind like water being poured in water. Let the mind flow into its own reality. Condition, release it into its own nature, letting it relax easily and openly will decisively and definitely block the womb door for all four forms of rebirth. Thus meditate again and again until the womb door is blocked. That's really difficult. That's like teaching Dzogchen in that moment. That's like teaching truth body. That's teaching refuge in ultimate dharma. That is that. Now, so those are five methods. I think they bear reading again and again and again. In a way, one might read them more to someone before they die. Really get it sort of down there in the unconscious of the person. And this whole thing of like how not to follow impulse, how not to feel bound like you're caught in a machine ever, how to let go. That's sort of the key. That's a total key, is how to let go.